All right, my first question concerns the actual process of writing. Do you have any sort of daily ritual which serves as a preparation for writing, or do you just sit down every day at a certain time and begin?
Well, the ritual is waking up, number one, and then lying in bed and listening to my voices. And uh-huh. So over a period of years, I call it my morning theater inside my head. And my characters talk to one another, and when it reaches a certain pitch of excitement, I jump out of bed and run trap them before they're gone. So I never have to worry about a routine. They're always in there talking.
How long do you write for?
A couple hours. So you can do, 3,000 or 4,000 words, and that's more than enough for one day.
How has the use of a computer affected your writing?
Not at all, because I don't use it.
You never use a computer?
Well, I can write faster on a computer than you can. I can write faster on a typewriter than you can on a computer.
Uh-huh.
You do 120 words a minute, and you can't do that on a computer.
No. Uh-huh.
So I don't need anything that's plenty fast.
Okay. Maybe we can have an interesting tie-in. I have some questions about technology later on. That's interesting.
Sure.
The way you're saying that the technology still hasn't caught up with you yet.
Well, if it won't be any more efficient than my IBM Selectric,
uh-huh.
why should I buy it?
Right.
It's for corrections, you know.
Okay.
I give it to my daughter, and she has a computer, and she puts in, and she then corrects it in the computer, and we have a record, so we have both worlds at the same time.
How about the imaginative process itself, the building of a story? How do characters and plots first arise? You've maybe covered this a little bit now.
Yeah.
I was going to say, do they appear spontaneously, or do they first originate in a carefully planned conscious construct?
Yeah. Planned thing destroys the creativity.
Uh-huh.
You can't think your way to a story. You have to live it.
Okay.
So you don't build a story.
Okay.
You allow it to explode.
Do you, for instance, use people and places out of the past, out of your own life at all?
Very rarely. More recently, in my two murder mysteries,
uh-huh.
The Death is a Lonely Business and the sequel, which just came out, the A Graveyard for Lunatics, and events in my past life are in there, some people that I knew, but most of my stories are ideas in action. In other words, I get a concept, and I let it run away. I find a character to act out the idea,
mm-hmm.
and then the story takes care of itself.
Okay. Let's just make sure this is... I have a fear of technology.
Well, these things have a way of, hamstringing you if you're not careful.
Yeah. I always fantasize about bringing two, but I never get around.
Well, I've done that on occasion.
Yeah.
Because there's this terrible thing that does happen after you've talked for an hour, and then you find that the tape is empty.
God.
And then you drink heavily or run out in front of a truck or whatever.
This last question is also in more or less in the line of what we're talking about now, which is that certain modern writers such as William Burroughs have used characters and settings first observed in dream states as the basis for fictional experiments. Others like Henry Miller have often spoken of being dictated to by the unconscious, which is sort of...
Oh, that sounds more like my cup of tea there.
Uh-huh. Have you had similar experiences with what might be termed as non-ego influences on a creative imagination? I mean, there are others, drugs or meditation or whatever.
Yeah, well...
Or dreams.
No, dreams don't work, and I don't know of anyone that ever wrote anything based on dreams constantly. You may get inspiration once every 10 years. But dreams are supposed to function to cure you of some problem that you have, so you leave those alone.
Mm-hmm.
That's a different process. But the morning process, when you're writing, when you're waking up, and you're half asleep and half awake, that's the perfect time, because then you're relaxed, and the brain is floating between your ears, huh?
Okay.
It's not attached. Or getting in the shower first thing in the morning, when your body is totally relaxed, the mind is totally relaxed. You're not thinking, you're intuiting, and then the little explosions, the little revelations come. Or taking a nap in the afternoon. It's the same state. But you can't force things. These people try to force things. It's disastrous, you know. Just leave your mind alone. Your intuition knows what it wants to write, so get out of the way.
Okay. Where did you fly in from?
From New York City.
That's my...
But I'm from Los Angeles.
New York's my hometown.
It's a good place to be away from.
Absolutely.
It's a shame, because I've been going there since I was 19, and I've watched the whole thing go to hell. And I have a lot of friends there, and I love the Metropolitan Museum and the Guggenheim, but I mean, how much love can you have for something?
It's almost as if it'd be wonderful to have a helicopter to just, you know, fly in and out of all those wonderful cultural assets.
it's
terrible what's happened there. Yeah,
yeah, the only livable place is down at Pier 17. South Street Seaport. Have you ever been down there?
Sure.
Yeah, it's great. Because
my father used to take me there before it became anything.
Yeah, and it's very social. It's very safe.
Yeah.
A lot of good restaurants. And I go up on the this restaurant facing the Brooklyn Bridge, Harbor Lights.
Oh, yeah.
A lot of wonderful Irishmen run the place.
Right.
And I go up and get drunk with them. I lived a year in Ireland, so... We get on very well. We talk about the Royal Hibernian Hotel and things like that. You know?
My family's from Ireland originally. My mother's side. You've been the recipient of numerous book awards. You've been received by world leaders such as Mikhail Gorbachev. When the Apollo astronauts landed on the moon, they paid you homage by naming the Dandelion Crater in honor of your novel, Dandelion Wine. How has this overall acceptance by people in positions of great responsibility affected your writing and your life?
Not at all. You just don't think about it. You shouldn't. The most dangerous thing you can do is know who you are. See, the Norman Mailer's problem is he thinks he's Norman Mailer. And Gore Vidal's problem is he thinks he's Gore Vidal. I don't think I'm Ray Bradbury. There's a big difference. Just do your work every day. Don't go around thinking, gee, you know, wow, to hell with that. The work is important, the work is fun, and there's no time. If you get into your work every day, there's no time to think who you are. So these are very nice things, and I was exhilarated by them when they happened. My day with Gorbachev was joyous, and I went home immensely happy. But then the next day, you got things to do. So it hasn't affected me at all.
One thing that I found continued to come out as I was preparing this interview were questions about your vision of the future. And I'm thinking now of a story that first appeared in the early 1950s, The Pedestrian. In this rather paranoid vision of the future, Mr. Mead is arrested and sent to a psychiatric center for having committed the transgression of walking without a purpose through the streets at night. It is a world in which you write that magazines and books didn't sell anymore, and people sit entombed in their homes, mesmerized by television sets. In many ways, this tale epitomizes the very dark undercurrent of the 1950s, yet there are forces at work in the world today that are not that dissimilar. What about your own personal vision of the future, especially the political future today?
Well, it's very optimistic. Look what's happened in the last 8 months. I mean, you know, because America stood firm and helped form NATO and just stayed quietly there, finally the communists gave up. You know, they were an evil empire. You know, Reagan was absolutely right. And they partially still are because they haven't finished disarming yet, huh? But who could have foreseen that the end would come so quickly and within just a matter of months. We said take down the wall. We implied it many times. Only one president ever said it, Reagan. he's not going to get any credit for it. Everyone hates him for being successful, because he's probably will go down in history as the most important president of the century, because he did end the communist empire, huh? Just by holding steady, being very quiet. And when the communists left the negotiating table 3 or 4 years ago, everyone said, President Reagan, don't do that. You know, call them back. He said, they'll be back. They have to come back, because their economy isn't working. So if we just are not belligerent, don't take advantage of it, don't rock the boat, they'll be back. And eventually the wall will come down. And it's exactly what happened. So 2 weeks ago, the Russians welcomed Reagan to Moscow, because he helped them get free of their own system. But it's ironic. It's beautiful. And the one president we thought would never be able to do this is the one who did it.
How about the opening of the East Bloc? How will that affect science fiction writing?
Well, it won't. I don't think it'll affect it much, because we're running ahead of all that. We've always talked about freedom. We've always talked about totalitarian governments. After all, Fahrenheit 451 is all about Russia and all about China, isn't it? And all about the totalitarians anywhere, have left or right, doesn't matter where they are. They're book burners, all of them. And Fahrenheit will continue to be a red book, by people all over the world, because they're still totalitarian governments and book burnings. So as long as that's true, or if the threat is true, that book will be read.
Okay. This past August, you celebrated what I believe was your 70th
birthday. That's right.
After devoting decades of your life to writing science fiction, have you arrived at any conclusion concerning the function of science fiction, either in our individual lives or in the life of the social collective?
Well, it's the most important fiction ever invented. It always has been. People haven't given it credit, because it has to do with the history of ideas. Dreaming an idea, birthing an idea, blueprinting an idea, making it into a fact, and then moving on to the next idea. The history of science fiction started in the caves 20,000 years ago. The ideas on the walls of the cave were problems to be solved. It's problem solving. And so primitive scientific knowledge, primitive dreams, primitive blueprinting to solve problems. And so I never really realized how honorable and how long the history of science fiction is. If you look on the walls of the caves, they had pictures of antelopes and gazelles and mammoths. And the problem there is, how do you kill them? And that's a science fiction problem, isn't it? You have to think of it first before you can solve it. Then you find ways of inventing knives and then spears. A spear is an extension of a man's arm and his imagination. And when you throw it, you're throwing your will, you're throwing your arm, and you're killing the animal. So that's science fiction dreaming becoming primitive fact. You finally find out how to kill animals so you can survive. Then how do you build a fire? That's science fiction, isn't it? As soon as you pose the question, that's science fiction, because you're imagining something and trying to figure out, geez, we can bring fire into the cave, but it goes out. We find it in the forest after the lightning strikes, and we grab it and bring it back, but the next day it's gone. How do you keep it forever? So you dream that, and then you solve it, and then you have science fact. Primitive science, So the whole history of mankind is survival. Science fiction dreaming, science factual finding, and then moving on to the next problem. How do you go to the moon, Science fiction, just 40 years ago. Impossible. I had to put up with people saying to me when I was 30, we're never going to do that. Come on, don't be stupid. You know, it's a silly thing to even think about. Why go to the moon? Why go to Mars? Well, all of a sudden, just a few years ago, we solved the problem. So the science fictional dream became the Apollo missions. So now we're dreaming of what? We're dreaming of landing men on the moon. We're dreaming of of going out to the other planets with manned missions eventually, sometime in the next 40, 50 years. Probably land on Mars sometime in the next 20 years. And look at the Hubble telescope. I take it it's beginning to function now. That's a dream goes a long way back, and was totally impossible. It was science fiction. Now it's out there looking at the stars. Eventually, we'll go to Proxima Centauri. That will be sometime in the next 1,000 years, maybe even sooner. If we can cut the speed, if we can make our rockets go half the speed of light, we can get out there in 8 or 10 years. Well, that's not bad. Anything longer than that is pretty hard on the human psyche, not to mention the human body. So, and then all the other things that have occurred, the invention of a Xerox machine, which is a printing press for every human being in the world, huh? That's why they don't exist in Russia. All these technological things are freedoms, huh? In the United States right now, most people couldn't tell you how many airplanes there are. You know, the private airplanes, huh? There are 900,000 aviators, huh? Private aviators. There are about between 200,000 and 300,000 airplanes, private, owned by individuals, and 20,000 landing strips. That's the freedom, isn't it? You go anywhere you want to go. The airplane doesn't exist in Russia. There's that. That's one freedom that's denied everyone, because they're afraid if they had airplanes, they'd leave the country. And there are very few telephones, because they don't believe in communication. That's a freedom. We have a telephone for every person in the country in America. There are no automobiles in Russia. That's yet to be invented.
If we can afford them, though, right?
Huh?
If you said we have a telephone for everyone in the country, everyone that can afford the telephone.
Everyone has a telephone, whether they can afford it or not. It's one of those things that people have regardless of their income.
Well, how about someone who's... What I'm getting at is your answers are picking other questions, picking interesting other questions, of course.
No, there's some things that all poor people have. Automatically.
Well, how about a homeless person in New York who doesn't
That's another problem entirely, which has to do with our emptying the lunatic asylums.
Yes.
25 years ago. It was a big liberal movement and conservative movement, too, because we hated lunatic asylums. We hated the idea of them.
Yes.
And we had medicines which we thought were going to work, right? It was an honorable experiment, but it didn't work. So those people are out there. Now we have to take them off the streets. You can't leave them out there. We've got
I worked in a program in New York that was involved with trying to find housing and jobs for homeless mentally ill people. It was one of the few programs that was set up to solve that problem.
Mm-hmm.
And I did encounter many people who barely got by, who had a home but couldn't afford a telephone or couldn't afford clothing or other things that we all take for granted.
Sure.
And what I'm getting at is, what I'm leading to is, what about, you seem to be portraying a very, you're talking a lot about the Soviet Union. I'm wondering about your feelings about totalitarian strains within the United States.
There are none.